The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Yeah, my name's Andy Cahan. I'm the program director here. I have to tell you that when I booked this event last May, I couldn't have anticipated the uproar over the works of Thomas Eakins. So to that end, I just want to thank the trustees of Thomas Jefferson Medical College for promoting this evening's event. As you might imagine, Professor McFeely is prepared to entertain any and all of your questions on the Agnew Clinic. Now, you're supposed to correct me. Philadelphia audiences, they don't let any mistakes go by. Yes, thank you. Okay, anyway, before we get started, please turn off your cell phones and et cetera. William McFeely has won many awards for his books, including the Francis Parkman Prize, the Lincoln Prize, and the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Ulysses S. Grant. With his wife, Mary Drake McFeely, here with us this evening, he edited Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs and selected letters from the Library of America. Among his other works is a highly respected biography of Frederick Douglass, as well as a fascinating study of the legacy of slavery, entitled Cipolo's People, A Long Walk into Freedom. Please welcome William McFeely.
You're welcome. It's wonderful to be here in Philadelphia. Aiken seems to be something of a topic these days, and I hope we can add a little bit to it. I thought maybe I would start with this. Can you read from Susan McDowell Aiken's letter? This was November 30th, 1929. I want you, it's Samuel Murray, want you particularly to know about it. Addie and I think it the finest opportunity and glad we can keep the pictures in Philadelphia. She and her friend Addie had just decided to give 50 works of art to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And that picture, painting, that's Susan Aiken's portrait of her husband. And I'm very fond of it, and it's over in the Philadelphia Museum now. It's really quite great. And simply because I've been told there's no way to avoid it, I think we better have a look. And the story on this picture really is quite fascinating. Right. It really is quite fascinating. He painted it in 1875. He had done some of his wonderful books, Rowing on the Schuylkill and Baseball and out hunting for rail in the marshes. And he'd also done some quite dour portraits of his sisters in their house on Mount Vernon Street. But this, he undertook this, and was to him his great, great painting. It was to be, I think, in a sense, what we would use in the slang for it would be his breakthrough picture. He thought this would make his career. He knew Gross. Gross had come over to take drawing lessons when Aikens was there, himself studying in the 60s. And Aikens, in return, had learned a great deal about anatomy, and he knew what he was doing when he was dealing with the anatomical details in this picture, which are very complex and very, very fine. The picture was to be displayed, he hoped, in the centennial exhibition, the 1876 celebration of the birthday of the country. He had a couple of other, other paintings selected by the Arts Committee, but they did not want this one. and the which their reasoning was, I think, nobody stated it, but it was really, in the end, really too real. It just was too much. Instead of being in the art pavilion, it wound up in a very weird thing. It wound up in a replica of a Civil War hospital, field hospital, which was most incorrect picturing of what a hospital looked like in the Civil War that I can think of. A neat row of beds with white blankets and sheets on them, also terribly orderly. It was a long way away from what those tents looked like when amputations were going on and the rest, and that ghastly carnage and ghastly wounding of men, mutilating of men in the Civil War. And this picture was at the end of the room. Now, I didn't realize until today when I was looking at this picture down at the Jefferson Medical School and realizing how fairly enormous. I've seen it, of course, before, but it was struck by how huge that painting is. It really is quite amazingly large. And it's hard for me to believe that tent area thing could have held it, but it did. But afterward, this painting was then exhibited a bit, but it didn't make much of a splash. After a few years, Gross's students bought it for the medical school for $200. I'm not sure that I'm happy about this business of big fat money and confusing it with trying to evaluate art. $68 million is a lot of money, and Philadelphia is going to have to go some to match it, and I certainly hope they succeed. But it is another sense Aikens, I think, would have been pleased that at last what he regarded as his finest painting has been sort of become the centerpiece of his work, his career. And now in help in a public museum where it can be appreciated by the hundreds and hundreds of visitors that come to our big city museums. So there you go. And now I think I would like to turn to another picture that has gotten a lot of controversy of another sort. Instead of seeing this thigh of a man having a bone, diseased bone cut out of his thigh, I thought we would go right to some picture of a lot of naked men. This is swimming. It was first entitled The Swimming Hole. I deliberately had this, kept the frame on it. It's the frame that it's in right now. In the Fort Worth Museum. Somehow, in closing this picture with the frame, somehow says exactly what I think Aikens was trying not to say with the picture. This, I think, was an outgrowth of his sports pictures, but yet it was far more immediate and intimate than that. You will notice that there are no other people in it except the boys, his students, not so young, boys at that. And he, of course, is down in the lower right-hand corner, the breaststroke, just watching the guys. He was an expert swimmer. It's not at all surprising that he was the first one in. Rutledge is diving into the water to be with him. Picture has now become, I don't know how to quite to put it, but it is the icon of the pounding on our chest gay members of the gay community who just see it as, to them, it's, there's no question about it, he's one of us. it seems to me that that's probably fairly accurate. I imagine he was indeed gay, but that is not by any means the whole message of this painting. It's really quite small as opposed to the Gross Clinic, about 3 feet wide, 2 feet high. He and his students, probably some favorite students, have found a swimming hole southwest of Philadelphia. There is no house in sight. There's a rock ledge which tells you that it had once been a mill pond, but almost nothing to break away from the kind of bucolic loveliness of the place. And it's a warm summer's day, and they're all having a very good time. It took really until this century in the 1930s with F.O. Matthiessen, the literary critic and professor of English at Harvard, to make a connection between this picture and Walt Whitman's poetry. He likened it to Whitman's poem, The 28 Bathers Bathe at the Shore. Like Aiken's picture, there is someone watching the bathers. In Whitman, it's a woman sneaking out in a kind of furtive way from behind the blinds. Aiken's is more frank than his friend across the river, Whitman. He is right there in the picture himself. It is, I think, something of a first-person narrative. As a teacher, I worked often in a course called American Lives with first-person narratives. Thoreau, Whitman, Jane Addams, Frederick Douglass. And I always listen to some music. It was usually Ives, The Wonderful Dissonant, America the Beautiful. And when it came to music, to art, Winslow Homer or some others, but the one I always had the most fun with was Aiken's. I came to think that this is his first-person narrative, perhaps his, you might say, his Walden. That struck me. After all, there was a pond in Thoreau's life, too. And a wonderful quote from it that a friend put me in touch with about how bracing a plunge into the pond at Walden early in the morning when you're all alone. And there's an intimacy in that, an immediacy about that touch with nature that Thoreau achieved. And I think Aiken's is doing something like that. As far as the business about Aiken's being gay, I was helped out by a line in a friend's book, a wonderful biography of Will Shakespeare, Will in the World, by Stephen Greenblatt. And he actually had to face something of the same problem. Everybody is always trying to assign those sonnets they must be referred to this lover or that lover. There's all kinds of speculation about it. But when push comes to shove, there is certainly intimacy, and it's very immediate. But it's Shakespeare's own. We gain nothing, I think, by knowing who his lovers were, nor do we have to imagine Aiken's in bed with one of these men. I think, in fact, we subtract from the picture greatly when we do so. It's had an interesting life. It was done in Philadelphia. It was exhibited. It was supposed to be, it was commissioned, and very few of Dakin's works were commissioned, but the chairman of the education department at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, Edward Coates, commissioned it. He was going to build a house, spoil the bucolic thing here, on this pond, and wanted a picture for it. He has always struck me as a slightly dim for the director of education at an art school. And I think when he finally had a look at it, he thought, this is going to be kind of a lot for our living room. And he asked Akins if instead he could take another picture. I think it was the concert singer of a pretty and nice picture, a picture that would be just fine in his living room. It was, the picture was exhibited, and for a short time, one exhibit after another, but not much. It never made, no attention was paid to it, anything. And I think it spent most of its life until 1917, just leaning against the wall at 1729 Mount Vernon Street. There were in the 1930s there were people who had been to the Akins house, of course, when it was still a private residence, and they do not recall this picture being on the wall. It would have been a very it would have made perfect sense for him to take the canvas with him over to Camden, take the ferry over to Camden to see Whitman. But there's no record of Whitman left. And Whitman there were many letters that Whitman wrote that told about Akins's visit over there. And I think he would have mentioned it had he ever seen this picture. And as I say, it was only really in the 20th century that someone got to the idea of what was being said here. Arthur Danto, an art critic that I think a great deal of, in what I'm afraid was a bit of a stretch, said it was our Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, they're naked. But I think, I take his point. And Linda Nochlin, another very fine critic who tends to gender issues, is very appreciative of this picture. It, incidentally, get back, this is definitely a tangential point, but it was about to be sold out in Fort Worth, and the Fort Worth people all got together. You will see the list of the people who contributed to the purchase of it. It's a great long list. They managed to raise $10 million and keep it in Fort Worth. I first saw it in the Philadelphia Museum before. It was not in the great big 2001 show here. I don't know why. But at that point, it was on loan to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And it was a marvelous moment. Doug Pascal, who was working there then, realized that I was pretty interested in the picture. He knew that I was starting a biography of Akins. And he took me in. The museum was closed that day. And he took me into the museum and let me have a look. And it was a wonderful moment. I wonder where you put Akins. Where is his? I'm willing to let him have the Gross Clinic as his great picture. I think that's right. But there's such a wonderful variety, and it's very hard to say quite where that man's expert hand would go. I have another couple pictures that I would sort of like to mention. I would say, though, on the back to the Gross thing again for a minute, Samuel Gross had knew Aikens. They both had done drawing together over at the Academy. But when Aikens was fired from the Academy, it was a terrible blow for him, and it was really quite a cause célèbre in the whole city. Professor Aikens resigns was the headline on an article in the newspaper, and there were many others about it. And the people took sides. Horatio Wood, he would be a psychiatrist now, a neurosthesian at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Weir Mitchell, also what we would call a psychiatrist. His friend William Marks, who was an engineer, they were all very concerned about him. Were very loyal friends. Horatio Wood arranged for Aikens to go out to his ranch that he owned in the Dakota Territory and spend the summer. Whitman has a marvelous letter in which he said, "You know, my friend Tom, he was looking so poorly, just terrible, and now he's back just in fine shape." So apparently Horatio Wood was the psychiatrist who knew what he was doing because it worked with Aikens. But before the breakdown, or as it was coming on, people took sides. And Samuel Gross wrote a memoir in which no honor that befell Professor Gross was left out. Including the fact that he said, a marble bust has been done of me, I humbly tell you about, and it's at the school, meaning the Jefferson School. Well, he never mentioned the Gross Clinic. Now, if anyone, how many of you know all there is to know about Samuel Gross? Probably not very many people know anything about him except how Aikens has made him famous. Yeah. I would like to show you just a couple of other pictures, and we have some questions. I'd love to just see how Philadelphians feel about him. This is finally my favorite of all of his paintings. It's Edith Mahan. The painting is at Smith College, and I was teaching up at Western Massachusetts, and so that I got to know the picture up there. I think it's very beautiful. There's a wonderful amount of light. A great deal of that white paint of Aikens is there. There's almost a tear in that eye. I think Aikens was seeing tremendous sadness in this woman. She was from England. She'd come over here to Philadelphia. She was a quite good pianist. She accompanied some professional singers and gave piano lessons here. She'd had a divorce, which was, not it in the 1890s. But Aikens was fascinated with her. Very few, I've talked about one picture that was commissioned, but most of his pictures, he had chosen people, telling them, you look like an interesting person, let me paint your picture. And that, we think, is what happened here with Edith Mahan. She didn't like it when it was finished, and I can understand that. But it says something in my book. It says something about the sadness that was in Aikens, and which he sort of found his own sadness in his great late dark portraits. Now, let's just completely jump the other way. That's John Biglin down on the river. It's a part of a larger painting, but we're miles away from the one that you were just looking at. And I just love the look at the ripples in the water and the absolute precision of the skull. and an anatomical perfection of the rowers and his arms and his hands and the bend of the body and the knees up the way they would indeed have been. There's an interesting picture that I included in the book. It's not a great painting, but it's an awfully nice one of an older woman who is knitting, and a expert in arthritis, a doctor, has spotted it and wrote a wonderful article on it, that the arthritic hands are absolutely accurate, that they are just the way the hands would be. As far as realism goes, I think we've never done better than Aikens. And so with that, I think I'd like to say thanks very much and ask you, if you wouldn't, ask me a few questions. Thanks. Here's one already. I think you want to pick on...
Folks, if you could just, we will get a mic to you momentarily. If you could keep your hand up, ma'am. Thanks.
Can you give any insight into what happened with his niece?
I wish I could give it to you with some assurance. That's Ella. I knew there were going to be pictures that I wish I had on the PowerPoint and don't. There's a lovely painting of the baby at play, it's called. It's a charming thing. It's a baby's on the floor, on the ground at the backyard at Mount Vernon Street, playing with a bunch of toys. She sort of pushed away a doll. There's a little wagon in it. It's really a lovely picture. And a very fine art historian, Jules Proun, has said this is a picture of the wonderful adventure that lies ahead for this woman, this child, who, when she becomes a woman. Well, she committed suicide, as which you must certainly know, and the chapter Ella is entirely devoted to that thing. Ella's parents, her mother was Egan's sister, and her father was an old friend going all the way back to Central High, I think. And they had a farm out at Avondale, down south of Philadelphia. And Aikens loved to go out there and play with his... He was sort of the favorite uncle. Aikens had no children of their own, but there was a swarm of kids in the Kroll family down there. At some point, they realized that she had mental troubles. And in fact, they got worse and worse. There was one time she loved to ride. When Aikens brought a pony back, or a horse back, both a pony and a horse, back from the Dakota Territory, she rode it down to the train station when he took the train down from Philadelphia. She was a very good horsewoman. But there was one account that she rode the horse so furiously that the horse was absolutely exhausted, and then she just furiously threw herself into the creek there and exhausted herself in it. She was in grave trouble, and the family committed her to the Norristown Insane Asylum. So there's no question, I think, that there was a mental illness in Ella. There's a photograph that Aikens took just the year before she died, and she's just gaunt, and it's so sad to see in comparison with that lovely painting. When she went upstairs in her house, where nobody was around at the time, she had a gun, she must have had a a stick that she had whittled with a trigger, and she shot herself and died. The coroner went out the next day and exonerated the family. It was clearly a suicide. And then this really kind of awful thing happened. She and her sister Margaret, Ella and her sister Margaret, had come in to stay with Aunt Sue and Uncle Tom and take courses at the academy. And Ella didn't take to it. She then tried nursing. She went in training for nursing. One of her patients died of a overdose of medication, and Ella almost died herself taking the medication. There's so many signals that this mental trouble was very, very real. But the Krolls, the parents, for reasons that I would love to know, but I can't really know, just decided that it was all Tom's fault. They had been wonderfully loyal during his time of being fired. There was a very close family, extended family. They'd have musicales out at the house in Avondale, and they just absolutely turned against Tom and blamed him for it. And it's so hard to imagine what he did. There's one reference to someone said it's like Oscar Wilde. It was the time of the Oscar Wilde trial in England. Which is to say, must have had something to do with homosexuality. But that doesn't make any sense because she was not a man. As far as I've been able to see, there never was any sexual... It was sexual stuff going on in the studio in the sense that these were very alive, very alert, wonderfully intelligent and wonderfully sensitive people, and they just simply the proximity to the naked body, which was something that Akins always insisted on. Whether she simply wasn't strong enough to stand up to that, I just don't know. I said at one point as in my discussion of it. Where there's that much smoke, one suspects fire. But I have not been able to find that fire. But the family's never reconciled. He never went down there again.
Next question, right here in the green, if you'd keep your hand up. Thanks.
Could you discuss his use of photography with his painting and... why was it so controversial?
In the first place, there's no better, except for the piano, there's no better thing to make you a proper bourgeois 19th century person. The camera was so popular. Everybody had to have one. And Akins went out and bought himself one, and he took an enormous number of pictures, and some of them are very, very good. I would love to see an exhibit of just his photographs sometime. In the big show in 2001, you probably all remember, and there's a chapter in the catalog about just how he would take a photograph. The most famous one is the shad fishing picture, where he had taken pictures, photographs of the men out with the nets in the boat, and then with infrared or whatever they do, they learned how he was able to put little dots on and reproduce it really quite remarkably in the painting. and he also had a bunch of people watching them from the shore. And when he got the painting nearly finished, he decided he didn't like that, them. So then he posed a bunch of his relatives at the same kind of slant on the ground, although it was not down next to the river, and painted and photographed them, put that on with his little red dots, and it looks perfectly believable. There's no way that I think you would ever guess that it was that was the way he'd done. It got very controversial because it seemed like cheating. You shouldn't have to do this. People came after they accused of fakery. A few people began to say, "Now wait a minute. This is the way he achieved what is a very fine painting, and that he was simply using a tool." Somebody finally said, "You know, it's like what is the term for the camera obscura?" Vermeer did that. And if you're in pretty good company, if you're painting in the manner of Vermeer, a lot of people didn't like having the photographs next to the paintings in that show. I thought it was fascinating. It was a bold decision by Darryl Sewell to do it.
Another question right here in the middle. Keep your hand up, please.
Could you talk about Aiken's feelings about the Philadelphia art establishment?
Well, I don't want to be rude here, but what was the Philadelphia art establishment? I mean, I'm serious. Who are you referring to?
I'm leaving it open to you. I'm assuming some of the people who decided against its painting being in the Centennial, perhaps the people at the Academy who decided you shouldn't be there.
Oh, well, all right, sure, okay. I mean, they are the very conservative people who see themselves as experts. They continue to exist in our time, and they can cause some real problems. Because they're not seeing a very good friend of Aiken's, and Aiken's painted a marvelous picture of him, said after the swimming, "It's the worst damn painting that Tom has ever done." Even if you don't like the picture, it certainly must have been always an interesting picture. I think it's fair to say that in a way there was not a very discerning art audience in Philadelphia at the time. I don't think that's insulting the city to say it. I think that it was true. There would be lapses in other cities as well, but this was he never had. In the time that he in Philadelphia, his work was exhibited, but it never made had the sense that this was important art in the way, say, Sargent's work was. The only really big show, it was never a real retrospective, the only big show came the year after he died, in 1917 at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It was a beautiful show. Luckily, we have photographs of it, and it's perfectly hung. Swimming is in the centerpiece on the wall. I think he just, you know, if he'd wanted that, he should have stayed in Paris. But I've always been sort of glad that he didn't, because I think he would have been kind of a second-rate impressionist instead of the superb realist that he is.
Folks, any more questions? All the way in the back there in the center.
Aikens was active at the time the Academy building was done. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did he have any impact on its design? Was he associated with Furness in any way? Did they have a relationship?
He must have known Furness, but I don't know of any connection with it. And he had no particular standing in the architectural world, so that I would be surprised about it. You obviously know it, the history of it. I mean, it was finished in 1876 at the time of the centennial. Isn't that right? I think so. And Aikens went in the building and taught. I don't recall any comment about the building, other than it was important to him as a place to do his work, and the fairly spectacular architecture wasn't commented on that I know of.
Why don't we take one more question right here in the second row?
Two questions. One is, how long did it take you to do the research on this? And the second is, what was your motivation in the first place that got you started?
How long did it take? When I started, I think it was about 5 years, which is short for me. It takes me forever to write a book. I spent 10 years on the Grant and on the Douglas. The motivation it was the teaching. That I got very curious about him. As year after year, I would trot out a painting of his, have the students look at it, listen to what they said about it, what they could read into it. It could have been Winslow Homer, I suppose, but it was never going to be Sargent. There's the down-to-earth quality about Aiken stuff that is so appealing to me. He's just wonderfully there for us. And I don't know. The other thing I have to admit is I just love to jump around and try different things. I wrote about a general and a president, and I wrote about an orator and an abolitionist. And I found both of them fascinating 19th-century figures. And somehow or other, Aikens... He fits and he doesn't fit. He had absolutely no social conscience that I can make out. He also managed to totally miss I'm not the only writer who looked at Aikens in the 1860s and wondered how on earth, what was he doing? He was at art school when Philadelphia was just, after all, the Civil War was waging a couple counties away from here. And some of his friends, Max Schmidt in The Single Skull, was a classmate at Central High. He went in the Army. So did a couple of other friends. It's a really kind of a mystery. Ultimately, when he reached, in 1864, when he reached draft age, he went around the corner and paid $25 for the bounty to not serve. He was extremely skillful at missing history. He left Paris just before the Commune. For an historian, this is upsetting, but it's true. Yeah.
Well, folks, let's end it there. Please join me in thanking William McFeely. No, ma'am, you could ask your question upstairs. Folks, we can continue the conversation upstairs. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.